Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's refusal to listen to the tape of the murder of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, provided by the Turks, and his dismissal of the CIA founding that the Saudi Crown Prince MBS ordered the assassination of the Saudi dissident. David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, joins us from London to discuss the extraordinary praise for the Saudis as spectacular allies coming from Trump in the face of damning evidence that the Saudi de facto leader is a violent thug who operates with impunity and with unbridled recklessness. We will look into the record of the serial disasters in Yemen and Qatar brought about by MBS's impetuous misrule and examine what hidden ties might be at play since from day one Trump has operated as a legal advisor for the Saudis, crafting cover-ups for them while chiding them that the assassination was a bad original concept which was carried out poorly rather than an appalling human rights violation carried out under diplomatic immunity on the soil of a NATO ally. We'll assess whether there are possibly secret financial ties between the Saudis and Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, which might explain why a top White House official responsible for American policy towards Saudi Arabia resigned on Friday evening. Then we'll get an update on the wrangling between the Trump White House and Robert Mueller, whose investigation Trump claimed is close to being wrapped up. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss the possibility that Mueller has a number of sealed indictments, which may include Trump as an unindicted co-conspirator. We will also assess whether Trump's hatchet man, the unqualified and possibly unconstitutional acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker, will block the release of the Mueller report or try to dilute its findings. Then finally, with the murder of a Green Beret by Navy SEALs and a decorated Navy SEAL accused of war crimes in Iraq, we will investigate the lawless behavior of some members of the U.S. Special Forces operating under JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command. Author, filmmaker, and journalist Robert Young Pelton, who has been on many operations with U.S. Special Forces, joins us to discuss the lack of supervision over SEAL teams who operate without commanding officers and the culture of impunity which allows some of these warriors to engage in criminal activity, drug abuse, and financial irregularities. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who have been helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, who formerly was the chief foreign leader writer for The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, and European correspondent and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Hurst.
Hi there.
Well, thanks for joining us, David. And what do you make of the resignation on Friday night of Christian Fontenrose, who had specifically advocated that Saud al-Khatani, the top advisor to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, be added to the list of sanctions on the 17 Saudis. She apparently was just in Saudi Arabia. She's on the National Security Council, where she serves as the director for the Persian Gulf region. And it looks as if something happened there. Do you think that the Saudis objected to her putting the prince's close aide on the list? Or, I mean, I guess we don't know, but what's your take on it?
Well, the excuse for getting rid of her by her superior was that she was communicating with Arab diplomats on WhatsApp. It's, of course, ironic because that is exactly what Kushner does. It's quite obvious, and it's been apparent for some time, there is a degree of ferment and turmoil going on amongst all the U.S. agencies. The CIA was very, very clear in its judgment that Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, both thought about the murder, conceived of it, and ordered it and directed it. And now there is, of course, a huge effort to try and rein the White House back from that point. It's very obvious why they're doing it, because, and it has very little to do with arms sales. It's to do with the fact that the Trump family, father and son, have invested so much in Mohammed bin Salman personally. And that if he went, which is the obvious conclusion of the CIA report, then the point man, but also the linchpin of so many policies, and so many, indeed, of Israel's policies, would disappear in the Middle East. Bin Salman has been extremely useful for Israel in pushing back the Palestinians, in telling them or attempting to tell them that they can forget about the capital in East Jerusalem. He's counseled with visas for Hajj, for Palestinians who don't have Jordanian passports. And basically, he's helped put the squeeze on quite a few policies that Trump, deal of the century, but also Jordan as well, has tried to apply. So if he goes, one could imagine that an awful lot of Saudi Arabia's foreign policy, foreign policies, would revert back to a much more neutral stance, and that would not help Trump or Kushner or indeed Benjamin Netanyahu. So there's a huge amount invested personally in Mohammed bin Salman. And it's, I think, quite nonsense to say, well, of course, if he left, it would destabilize the kingdom. His arrival has destabilized the kingdom. And in particular, in order for him to be crown prince, he got rid of a much more senior, much more trusted elder cousin, Mohammed bin Nayef, who was crown prince, and was a foreign policy counter-terrorist habitué of Washington and very close to the CIA and the Pentagon. So to say that to keep Mohammed bin Salman because of stability is a bit of a nonsense if you know anything about how he got to power.
Well, he was brought to power, at least in terms of encouragement and lobbying by the Trump administration over the objections, I understand, of the foreign policy establishment. I don't know whether it's another case of Trump being anything that Obama had to do with, he reverses, because the outgoing CIA chief was very, Brennan was very close to Mohammed bin Nayef, whether that's part of that pattern. But when you say, David Hurst, that he's got to go, meaning MBS, my understanding is that he's nevertheless popular in the kingdom, and that his father is sort of doddering, perhaps with early onset of Alzheimer's. So is there any effort underway or any possibility? The only person who could remove him...
He is popular amongst the youth, but they've yet to open their wallets. And when they do, I think he'll become slightly less popular. This is a crown prince for whom really nothing has gone right. He has attempted a part privatization of Aramco, and that IPO has failed. He applied austerity and then had to lift it again. He embarked on the Yemen war, and you'll be talking about that later, with disastrous consequences. He started a siege of Qatar. And in each of these policies, but particularly the economic policies, actually nothing has really worked. Yes, one can say that he has given a real modicum of freedom to women in Saudi Arabia, but he's nowhere near allowing them to vote or have any real political rights. And this is what Jamal Khashoggi and I were talking about just before his death, that you cannot have economic reform without a modicum of political reform. And what's been happening is that the people who masterminded Jamal's death were also the ones who were really behind a reign of terror on the streets of Riyadh, and everyone was affected by it. Now, a senior prince has returned from London. He's the younger brother of King Salman, Prince Ahmed, and he has very, very much gone to muster opposition within the family to Mohammed bin Salman, and see whether that can be expressed through the one institution that still exists, which is an institution called the Allegiance Council, which nominally at least has to verify and vet the next king. Of course, none of these powers really exist anymore because Mohammed bin Salman has seized all the powers. I mean, that's slightly the problem of having done something as stupid as try to kill a dissident journalist. You can't, on the one hand, argue that he has taken all the powers onto himself and actually the command of all three Saudi Arabia's armies and reorganized the security forces and intelligence forces, and on the other say that you don't know about an operation that was carried out by five of your own men and was personally organized by your right-hand man from your own private office, which is what happened. So I think the situation is much more unstable, and there's still more drama, much more drama to come from this. If, for instance, he goes ahead and executes five of his own men who carried out this operation, that really is a really bad message to send to any loyalist who carries out his orders. If you carry out my orders, basically, and the operation goes wrong, I could hold you responsible and kill you. That's on the one hand. If, on the other hand, he doesn't, he just whisks them away and kills five other people, then that would be further proof that he's more involved with the operation than he makes out in the West. So he's in a real crisis at the moment, and Saudi Arabia's in a real crisis. So whatever Trump decides or doesn't decide to do, there's still quite a lot of mileage left in Saudi Arabia itself. Now, that said, I think that he will survive because that's what happens with dictators who have all the power. They do survive much longer than they should. But I think he'll be damaged goods, certainly in Europe and certainly in the West. I don't think he'll be able to, after this, turn up on the streets of London as he did, with billboards showing his face as a new Saudi reform. I don't think I think he's lost the US media, which did play a part in trying to portray him as a young reformer. I think there's a real problem now. I mean, there are other ways of managing the situation, and one of them would be for him to take a back seat for a while and allow one of his brothers, he has an elder brother who's educated in Oxford, to take the reins. But I basically don't think that appeals to him, because this is a situation where he's taken all the power, and it is, I think, it'd be very, very difficult for him to, for instance, resign his roles, his security roles as defense minister, interior minister, and whatever, and just become an economic reformer. That could be one sort of solution to this problem, but I don't think that will happen. I think it's a one-way street with him, and he has determined that he's the next king the kingdom, and that's probably what he's going to be.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, David Hurst, so if Donald Trump were to cut ties or to basically cut him loose and stop defending him and stop giving him advice, it would seem, almost like a lawyer, as I mentioned in the opening, that would make a difference, would it not?
Well, yes. I mean, I think there are two very powerful factors operating here. One is the House of Saud itself, what family actually think. And they may well think that it is he's the devil we know, and for their own collective safety, they have to go behind him. And the other factor, of course, is Trump. And Trump has the power to make or break or select who the next king of Saudi Arabia has been. In fact, every American president has had that power. And obviously, no one seeing how Trump makes his decisions can be confident now of his judgment. But I would make the case that this isn't really a question of values anymore. I don't think foreign policy operates on that on any scale. It is a question of realpolitik. And if you really are an American president and you are concerned about the stability of the region and you're concerned about the stability of your bases in that country, you've got to think twice about a 33-year-old prince who, in the CIA's words, goes from 0 to 60 in a few seconds and completely loses his cool and shows, in fact, glaring errors and of judgment. That has got to be a concern. And so I think there's a lot of turmoil in the American-Saudi relationship to come if you have Trump as president and if you have Mohammed bin Salman as the future king of the kingdom.
And just in closing, it seems that the resignation of the National Security Council specialist on Saudi Arabia, obviously John Bolton fired her or forced her out. But it's interesting to note that on the list of sanctions, the one important person who should have been sanctioned, Ahmed al-Asiri, who's the deputy head of Saudi intelligence and a very close confidant of Prince Mohammed, he was not sanctioned. So it seems that behind the scenes, the White House is weighing in, still trying to protect MBS.
Yes. I mean, you've got to remember that Saudi Arabia has changed its story many times about what actually happened in the Kalinga. Initially, they said that they didn't know where he was, and he left the building, the consulate in Istanbul, 20 minutes after he came. And in the same way, the Trump administration has changed its reaction. And it's not finding the whole process very comfortable. And so I think these positions are very fragile. And I think it will be very, very easy whenever they finally settle on a version of the story that they feel comfortable with to demolish it with more evidence, because there's more evidence coming out virtually every day from Turkey that is proved on the whole to be absolutely reliable. And the interesting thing about the CIA statement was that the evidence that they used was culled from their own intercepts and their own sources. In fact, there was one phrase that they picked up in a telephone conversation between the head of the killer squad and Qahtani, Saud al-Qahtani, who's the right-hand man of bin Salman, when one said to the other, well, tell the boss and the deed is done, the boss presumably meaning bin Salman, that conversation and those words were not on the original Turkish tape. In other words, You had one conversation going on between a mobile in Turkey and another one in Saudi Arabia, but the Turks didn't have the entire transcript, or maybe didn't have the response. And the Americans did. And it's interesting that they used their own intercept and actually made that public. So this is a huge embarrassment for the White House. I think the White House are panicking, and that is why they are trying to basically get rid of all dissenting voices within the State Department. They've done that before. One major dissenting voice about Saudi Arabia was Rex Tillerson. They got rid of him. But look where it's landed them. They're in a big, big mess. If indeed they do think of Mohammed bin Salman as the linchpin of their Middle East policies, their Middle East policies are in an even bigger mess.
Well, David Hurst, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Hurst, who's the editor of Middle East Eye, who formerly was the chief foreign leader writer for The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, European correspondent, and Ireland correspondent for The Guardian. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether or not Trump's hatchet man, the unqualified and possibly unconstitutional acting attorney general, Matthew Whitaker, will block the release of the Mueller report or try to dilute its findings. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Scott. And if you were representing Julian Assange now, what would you be advising him now that we've learned that there was an accidental revelation on the part of some court filings in Virginia that he had been indicted by the Justice Department, that Assange has already been indicted by the Justice Department?
Well, we still, of course, don't know exactly what the charges are that are being brought against him, but I would be advising him to do everything he can possibly do to maintain his asylum and not give it up, because I think once he's in the clutches of the United States and tried, his situation is going to be extremely difficult.
Well, it's a very interesting, isn't it, that and we were talking earlier with David Hurst in London about the disarray within the administration or the government itself over how to deal with the Saudis, with the CIA naming MBS as the author of the assassination, and Trump's and his family desperately trying to rescue this terrible choice they've made in putting all their chips on this guy. So there's a lot of wrangling going on there, but there also seems to be a bit of a divergence because I understand that Pompeo, when he was at the CIA, initiated investigations into Assange and decided that he was no longer protected as a journalist by the First Amendment, and that he put the considerable resources of the CIA at his disposal to find a way to get Assange.
That's right. I mean, the key thing is, were Julian Assange plain and simple a journalist who received leaked information and published it, I don't think he would have much of a problem. But the facts here are a lot more complicated. I mean, if we call him a journalist, he's an unorthodox journalist, that's for sure. His publication is a new kind of publication. We don't know all the details of some facts here. And we know from publications by The Guardian, which at one point championed Julian Assange, that he has a very disturbing relationship with Russian intelligence services. We know that through the Spanish security guards who were in place in the Ecuadorian embassy, who maintained a log of everyone who came and visited and who shared that information with The Guardian. And we also know it from their exploration and their discovery of an exfiltration plan put together by Russian intelligence to get Julian Assange out of the embassy in London and back to Moscow. And all those things suggest that, he's an asset for Russian intelligence. But we don't have all the details we certainly don't know all the details that the CIA and the U.S. government knows. And we haven't heard Julian Assange's side of this whole story other than his blanket denials, I think a lot of which at this point don't really stand up very well.
Well, it's hardly a coincidence that the server for WikiLeaks is in St. Petersburg.
Yes, and they're just interesting questions about how he acquired it, the mode for transfer of this information to him, which seems to have been on media devices provided by possible Russian agents, the fact that he hasn't run any disclosures that are critical of Russia throughout this period. I mean, it goes on and on and on. I mean, to the fact that, even the lawyer he's been using for part of this is being hired and paid by Oleg Deripaska, a big Russian oligarch. So all these things raise, I think, some pretty serious questions.
So let's turn then to the Whitaker situation, where it's so clear that the Trump has put in a hatchet man in there as acting attorney general, and there's constitutional questions. In fact, there's a whole group of conservative Federalist Society lawyers who formed a group now, it seems, in response to this act on the part of Trump to basically try and force him out. And there's also a lawsuit that may well make its way to the Supreme Court, in which a defendant is using as his defense that the Attorney General himself, the head of the Justice Department, is not constitutionally appointed.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'd say in this area, just speaking with legal experts and law professors about it, and former prosecutors and senior DOJ officials, I haven't really found a difference in viewpoint between Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives. Everyone I talk to who's a serious scholar of these things believes that his appointment is not lawful, that that Trump had the right to appoint as interim pretty much anybody, provided that person is a confirmed official of the DOJ. He didn't have a right to appoint just anyone, so this individual doesn't meet the basic qualification hurdles, and as acting, the scope of what he can do is extremely limited. I mean, most likely he can do nothing whatsoever. Whereas Rosenstein, of course, would have been a perfectly lawful acting attorney general. He was already deputy. Deputy basically is the acting attorney general most of the time, who actually handles all the affairs of the Justice Department. And it's reasonably clear, I think, that Whitaker was trying out for over a period of time for this slot, and he tried out by going on television and saying, describing the techniques he would use to shut down the Mueller investigation. And indeed, a friend of mine, a professor at St. John's University, John Q. Barrett, tells me that in the green room, when they were both getting ready to go on CNN, he was told by Whitaker that, yeah, I'm doing this because I'm trying out to get an appointment from Trump. And it's clear that Trump watched, saw, and approved.
Right. Well, it was clearly an audition. And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. So it looks as though Trump's going to appoint Pam Biondi or nominate her as his next attorney general. I don't know how quickly that will happen. Of course, her claim to fame is that she was joining in with New York on a suit against the fraudulent Trump University. A lot of apparently the victims of Trump's scam were down in Florida, and then Trump gave her a campaign contribution of $35,000, and she promptly dropped Florida's role in the lawsuit.
He also allowed the use of Mar-a-Lago as a campaign fundraising site for her, which is another form of contribution. So that all looks suspicious. And, of course, that lawsuit was obviously meritorious, and it won. It succeeded. It obtained a very large settlement for the participants. So I imagine if her nomination goes forward, she's not going to have an easy time of it. I mean, she might win because the Republicans will have a majority, but I think she's going to face some pretty sharp questioning, and it's just possible that a couple of Republicans will say no to her. She certainly would not be a particularly qualified appointee for the position, and in particular because she doesn't have experience in senior levels at the Department of Justice, and that's usually viewed as a prime factor. You usually would want someone who's been a prior U.S. attorney or an assistant U.S. attorney at some point.
So you mean she might be less qualified than Betsy DeVos?
Well, she has a law degree. I mean, that's a big difference.
Oh, right.
She would be highly qualified for a position on Fox News. No
right.
doubt about that.
Yeah, well, she'd be a veritable intellectual on that cabinet with that kind of credential. But Whitaker, though, I don't know whether Trump's embarrassed, because Whitaker's resume is rather like Trump's in terms of being a fraudster. We're talking about Trump University. My God, this world patent marketing operation that Matthew Whitaker was on the board, and he was hawking their products in promotional videos, and then he was intimidating people who'd been ripped off by the company. I mean, so, you know, these hot tub seats, another one, DNA evidence collected in 2013 proves that Bigfoot does exist. He also offered a time travel patent that possibly within the next decade we'd be doing time travel. And, of course, the pièce de résistance was a patent application for an extra deep masculine toilet for the well-endowed above-average male genitalia in the promotional material. I mean, what do you do, laugh or cry?
No, I mean, you know, it's evidence that he could not be confirmed for the position of attorney general. And I think, you know, that matter is the subject of a criminal investigation right now. And he, as attorney general, would be the ultimate supervisor of a criminal investigation, of which he is also a subject. That's an impossible position. And when he's been asked repeatedly to clarify that he's recused himself from this, and the only thing he said in response is that he's seeking ethics guidance from within the department on that subject. But, I mean, there's really no issue about it. He couldn't possibly be involved in that.
So, Scott Horton, where do you think the things stand? I mean, the president himself the other day suggested that the Mueller investigation was wrapping up. There are obviously different parts of the investigation, the obstruction of justice being a big part, but then the Russia involvement. And of course, the president said he'd answered all the questions himself, which nobody believes. But they've been dragging that out. I don't know whether there's a strategy on the part of the White House to try and run out the clock. They've had these questions for months and months and months. So let's begin with the question of whether or not Mueller really needs these responses from Trump. I assume that he would like to have them basically as a matter of courtesy, that since all the underlings are probably pointing upwards saying, you know, he made me do it, pointing at the boss, at least you've got the boss on the record.
That's exactly right. So I think, does he have to have it? No, he doesn't have to have it. But I think any criminal investigation covering the grounds that this one is covering would obviously attempt to complete a full examination under oath of all the major subjects, and he is subject number one. So it seemed to me pretty clear he was going to be asked questions either directly before a grand jury or through a less formal method, which is what we wound up with here, this interrogation form, and that that would likely be the last thing that would occur in the investigation before it's concluded. So the fact that he's being asked to answer those questions and that they're about to be submitted suggests to me that that part of the investigation is likely coming to an end. Now, I say that subject to the fact that, you know, a subsequent discovery or new information could always cause them to do something else. So prosecutors, you know, hate to say that. But I would say the key, the witness in the center is always the last person who's examined. So this fact would suggest that they're coming to the end. And from what I understand, there were discussions between Rod Rosenstein and Mueller about winding up at least the first part of the investigation by the end of the year. And I don't think that there was a firm commitment given to that. But I think that Mueller, you know, he is working to try and move as expeditiously as possible. And if you look at the way he's handled this so far, this is a very fast-moving investigation. And it's possible that a part of it will be concluded soon.
Well, but if Trump wants to shut it down via his lackey, Whitaker, he'd have to do it soon before the Democrats are seated in the House in January.
Well, I think, you know, what does shutdown mean in this context? So we have a part of the investigation that's going to continue and a part that will be wound up soon. I think most of the investigation is done, so all they're doing is writing up the report. There's little he can do that'll stop them from writing up the report. What he can do is stop them from disseminating the report, making it public, making it available to Congress, and that's what I assume he's going to do. And then we have the investigation that's not wrapped up that will continue, which appears to be the obstruction aspect of the case, and possibly a few other aspects. And, of course, he could stop that or shut it down. As he suggested in his talk on CNN, he would shut it down by cutting the budget for the special prosecutor, simply not giving him the staff and the funds to proceed. And if that happens, I think we would hear probably some form of intervention from Congress.
Right, but there's already Mitch McConnell has brazenly refused to entertain a bill that would protect Mueller, and it's prompted Jeff Flake to try and use his leverage on the Senate Judiciary Committee to block judicial nominees.
That's correct. And we know from public statements of senators that that bill does have a majority in the Senate, right? And it certainly would have a majority in the new House. Now, of course, it might be vetoed by Donald Trump. That's a possibility. But it's being obstructed now, really, by Mitch McConnell personally.
Well, so why do you think that there'd be enough public outrage? There'd be a lot of public outrage, but I don't think the Republicans are going to do anything about it, are they?
No, I mean, we know from statements of Republicans, and as I count it, there are at least five Republicans who support the bill. I mean, it did get a large majority, near unanimous support in the Judiciary Committee. So it's not for lack of votes. You know, it's the leadership, the party leadership's decision within the Senate to hold it back.
Right, but that would indicate to me that Trump might be able to get away with it or think he can get away with that.
Yes. Well, look, the bottom line is, even if it's passed, he can veto it.
Right. No, but I'm talking about the report itself. If protection of Mueller is not even going to happen, that's laying the groundwork for Whitaker to roll over Mueller.
I think, you know, the likelihood is that Whitaker will take steps to block the dissemination of the report. He'll take it, put it in his pocket, and say, "That's it. Thank you. Your investigation is now concluded," and we'll stop it from going to Congress or anywhere else.
And that's when I think we can have some battles. I mean, I think obviously the House will be in a position to subpoena and demand it. And I think in a setting of that sort, the likelihood that it will be obtained by Congress is very, very high, and then the likelihood that it will be leaked is very, very high. That's sort of the way things work in Washington. So I think likely we will know his report and what he's concluded.
Well, just in closing, though, is that damage control for Trump? In other words, it's from Trump's point of view, it's better to have the report leaked in fragments and not have the credibility and the imprimatur of an official report coming from Mueller.
That's exactly right. So he will have some effect through these tactics if Matthew Whitaker proceeds with them, but not total. So it'll be something of a muting of Mueller and his investigation, but not really a silencing of it.
But just to finish up on the suit against Whitaker, do you think that's going to throw a spanner in the works in terms of Trump and Whitaker's strategy here?
Yes. I mean, most experts I've talked to expect that suit to succeed. You're talking about the Maryland suit.
So the Maryland suit that may go to the Supreme Court, right?
Right. And in fact, we see a number of other cases where people are getting ready to file the same motions. I think most people I've talked to think that ultimately these will succeed. I mean, the law is actually pretty clear and it's pretty adverse to Whitaker. And when that happens, that'll create a crisis over the Justice Department. And I think it's going to then force a replacement of Whitaker with someone who is a constitutional acting attorney general.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My great pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the apparent lawless behavior of some members of the U.S. Special Forces operating under JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He is the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had a firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi rebel and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, License to Kill, Hired Guns in the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurists. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Young Pelton.
Hi, Ian. How are you doing?
Well, thanks, Robert. And you've been on a number of operations with U.S. Special Forces in Afghanistan and elsewhere. So what do you make of these stories coming out now? The Army Staff Sergeant Logan Melgar was murdered. He was a Green Beret. He was murdered in Mali in June of 2017, apparently at the hands of members of SEAL Team 6, and then, of course, a decorated Navy SEAL has been accused of war crimes in Iraq. Is there a problem with the lack of supervision of these special forces?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, people that go out to become part of these elite units are vetted, trained, tested. They work within a supervised environment, but then when they go out into the field, obviously, there's less supervision, but having a supervisor in these two instances, I don't think would have stopped what happened. Now, in the case of Gallagher, who his own teammates are actually trying to prevent him from killing civilians, this should have been something that the team should have reported, not something, you know, that a supervisor needed to. So there's obviously a major gap there. And there's also a code of brotherhood in which you don't rat out your teammates. So maybe a cultural thing and just the lack of willingness to show that one of their team members was going off the reservation.
But SEAL Team 6, for example, they don't have officers, do they? They have chiefs, but they don't have officers in charge.
Well, they have officers in name. I mean, both U.S. Special Forces, which is typically a 12-man team with a junior officer, and also SEALs have a junior officer. But the team is made out of non-coms, and they are technically in charge, even though the officer outranks them. And, yes, there should have been an officer who would have been privy to these things, and yes, the officer should have done something, but obviously nothing happened.
Well, you know Eric Prince very well, Robert Young Pilton, and he seems to have that kind of swashbuckling attitude. I mean, it looks as if Mueller's going to indict him. I think he was involved with this extraordinary character, Nader, who has been arrested for child pornography and sex with a minor boy. He nevertheless was given highly secret operations on the part of both, as far as I can tell, the Trump people and the Saudis. And they negotiated with MBZ and MBS that Eric Prince would help them, or he was negotiating with Nader and MBZ and MBS to assassinate the head of the Iranian Quds Force. And that, of course, might well have provoked a war. Who knows what those IRGC people would do in Iran with their hero being murdered. So that is an example of somebody that's, off the reservation, if you will. And then Ryan Zinke, also a former Special Forces guy, he seems to have a pretty lackadaisical attitude to certainly to ethics, let alone the law.
Well, I mean, to be crystal clear, you know, I've been through the training program, parts of it for U.S. Army Special Forces, and I've taught Navy SEALs. They are different animals. I mean, a Navy SEAL is someone that goes out, attacks an objective, and comes back. U.S. Army Special Forces might have to sit there for 6 months with locals training them. But then once they move into these what they call black side units, which would be Delta Force in the case of Army or DEVGRU in the case of SEALs, they work on some very bizarre missions with the blended teams, and typically with the CIA and local hit squads. And they are doing things that aren't read about and heard about in the public. So, yes, you do tend to get into the dark side of things. And you have to remember these multiple deployments, these constant exposure to random violence from terrorists can tweak somebody. And if you're taking steroids, or if you're involved in what they call b-balling, you know, you can get hyper-aggressive. So in the case of Gallagher, you know, he was taking both steroids and painkillers, and he was involved in multiple incidents in which his teammates were quite concerned. On the other story, which is in Mali, which is just a brutal murder, you had an ex-MMA fighter who wanted to do something, they called it hazing, you know, out of revenge, and ended up crushing the Special Forces soldier's windpipe. Then they tried to hide it up. So there were two MARSOC members and two SEALs. And again, remote location, nobody watching what they're doing, doing something that they thought would be funny or whatever, turned into a murder. So, yes, this is something that should be scrutinized. Are these people off the reservation? Are they doing other things?
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had firsthand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi, rebel, and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurists. So, Robert, what then is the chain of command, if you will, with Joint Special Operations Command. First of all, they have an enormous budget. I think they have a bigger budget, certainly, than the CIA's paramilitary budget by leaps and bounds. And they've been throwing money at a lot of operations. So what kind of, accounting goes on? You know, because there are rumors and reports that there's not just been drug abuse amongst some of these special operations teams, but some financial irregularities as well.
Well, okay, so there's two levels. There's white side and black side. So white side special operations are people that go out and they train indigenous forces or they support military activities. And these are the people we're typically used to seeing. On the black side, you have blended groups or SMUs or even SMUs. These are groups of individuals who go after, let's say, bin Laden or after high-value targets. They're working together in an environment that is not closely supervised because there aren't a lot of people there, and they are required to operate on their own steam, for lack of a better word, because they get into a lot of very violent, confusing situations. These people are sort of the best of the best. So when there's a bad apple, if you want to call it that, you can typically trace this to psychological problems or going off the reservation, they call it, when you just lose it. I don't think that these two instances are typical, even though the whole birth of SEAL Team 6 is rooted in Dick Demo Marchenko sort of being the red team, you know, going against the officers and the traditional thinking. So maybe that culture gets amplified too hard when they're out in the field, and these are just two windows into when it goes badly wrong.
Yeah, I remember talking to Marchenko years ago about, I think he broke into a nuclear submarine base, didn't he?
Well, that was his job. He got booted out for financial irregularities, and you have to remember these groups carry lots of money to pay off informants or to buy cars or whatever they have to do. And there have been instances that I've been exposed to where there have been financial irregularities, but these things are typically solved internally. On the violent side, I can tell you from personal experience that, you know, when you go in on objectives and you've got maybe a dozen doped up jihadis fighting until the death, even when they're bleeding to death, you know, shooting you after they surrender, there are extremely violent retribution and incidences that are not revealed to the public.
Yeah, I don't know whether you've seen this new movie. I interviewed the filmmaker, Syrian, of Fathers and Sons.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing film. It's really, it opens, I think, on Friday here in L.A. Gives you an insight into how jihadis are recruited and influenced. And the main character, of course, is a Al-Qaeda bomb maker who offers up his sons to Al-Qaeda. It's just extraordinary. Just to finish up then on this story that's coming out, or at least bits and pieces of the story, you don't think this is a particularly endemic situation where you've got a lot of money flowing around, a lot of weapons, not a lot of supervision, and God knows how many countries the U.S. is operating in. And my understanding is that special operations, which began under President Kennedy, have grown enormously in number as a ratio to the regular armed forces. So given that broader picture, how would you describe the situation in terms of how many bad apples are there?
If you've watched an ISIS video or if you watched 9/11, we have created a group of men and women who are what we consider to be the best of the best, and we expose them in multiple rotations against these extraordinarily violent people. And we're asking them to be creative, and we're deliberately looking the other way while hoping we fight a clean war against a dirty enemy. So I think there's going to be incidences like this when you put people in front of such a violent enemy in such a violent place. It's almost hypocritical to think that we can fight a clean war against a dirty enemy. And these two gentlemen, you know, when they started off, they were well vetted, they were talented, and they were, you know, part of the best. As they went wrong, it's because of psychological exposure to violence. You know, people snap, mistakes happen. So I think the military is actually doing a good job of cleaning out its brotherhood. And when these things hit the media, we're shocked. But can you imagine the amount of violence these people are exposed to on a weekly, monthly, yearly basis?
And that's much more so than regular army, right? So what are the procedures with PTSD? And do they have some protocols to recognize it and deal with it?
Yes, but that's when you're with a group of men and you're going in to kill another group of men, you don't say, oh, I don't feel like it today, I'm not feeling very good, or I had sweats. I mean, my friends sleep with masks because they stop breathing in the middle of the night. I mean, they've been exposed to so much violence that they're over 100% disabled. So do we have, like, a soft, cuddly blanket for men that we train to kill? I'm not a psychiatrist, but you're seeing the outgrowth of a long-term violent war against violent people.
So what's in the last couple of minutes then? Is there anything going to result from these revelations of these two incidents? And, of course, two incidents don't make an epidemic.
No, I don't think so. But I would encourage people to read books like My License to Kill or other books by Sean Naylor and people like that who have been exposed to what they do at the tip of the spear. You know, the things that you don't necessarily read about, the necessary killing of women who pull a gun and the bombing of houses full of children. I mean, just things that we would think abhorrent are done on a regular basis. So, you know, I've been to Syria, Libya, I've been to, you know, Mazar. So I'm just saying we're fighting this war all over the world. And if we were truly clued in to how much violence we perpetrate through JSOC and special forces, I think we'd be grateful that all these people don't snap.
Well, that's apparently what's going on now. I mentioned that film of Fathers and Sons, which is filmed in Idlib. And apparently there's a very violent operation underway now by special forces and U.S. military, along with the Kurds, to wrap up the last of the al-Qaeda in or al-Nusra in Syria. And there are also reports of civilian casualties.
Well, they're methodically killing every single member of ISIS. There's no interest in taking prisoners. You know, we have lists of thousands of people who are methodically taken out with, Predator drone missiles. We have assassins who take out, you know, members of drug cartels and militias. I mean, we are fighting a very broad-scale war. And like I say, when it comes home to us and we see one person who seems to be insane, you know, because he's killing children, he's doing this, we have to stop and think about who his enemy is and how he got that way.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Young-Pelton.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Young-Pelton, who's an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer. He's the publisher of Dangerous Magazine and has had a first-hand perspective on the war on terror from direct contact with the world's most infamous jihadi rebel and insurgent groups. And his books include The World's Most Dangerous Places, Come Back Alive, License to Kill, Hired Guns, and the War on Terror, and his autobiography, The Adventurist. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program's available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review it on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.